Happy New Year. I hope your 2020 is starting off with a bang. Thank you for listening to Author Stories through 2019 and all of the previous years. We had an amazing year last year and looking forward to doing bigger and better things this year. Before we get into the interview, we're going to thank a couple of sponsors who make the show possible. Please give them a shout out and look them up on Amazon and make sure that you tell them that you appreciate their sponsorship of Author Stories. At the end of the show, we're going to have an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War. This audio clip is narrated by the one and only Luke Daniels. You're going to love this series. I love it so much. And Richard has been a great supporter and sponsor of the show, and we're going to show him some love. Listen to the audiobook excerpt. You're going to love it, and be sure to go to audible.com to purchase it. If you're not an Audible subscriber, you can get a free book just by signing up for a free trial at audibletrial.com/Hank. You get a 30-day free trial. You get the free book. If you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, you get to keep the free book, and it doesn't cost you a single penny. audibletrial.com/Hank, and listen after the show for the clip from Richard Fox.
We're so happy to have our friend Crystal Pico Watanabe as a sponsor of the show. Crystal is one of the best editors in the business, and she has just debuted a new service that I think you'll absolutely love and will help you to up your writing game. Pico's School of Wordcraft and Editing has just debuted, and the first course is called Properly Punctuating Dialogue. It's a mini course and can be completed in just about 20 minutes. It covers the basics of dialogue punctuation. Authors can get access to the new school and the course for free by signing up for Crystal's author newsletter, Notes from Pico. Go to picoshouse.com/newsletters. That's PIKKOSHOUSE.com/newsletters. More in-depth courses will be added in 2020. Make sure you don't miss a thing. PicosHouse.com/newsletters. Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC, without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today. Visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Who Wants to Love a Billionaire? Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton. Julie does not love being the center of attention. She makes dresses for those who do. But when Emily, her matchmaking friend, begs for a favor, Julie can't say no. It was supposed to be just one date. She never expected to kiss the guy, then fall head over heels for him. When threats start rolling in, it becomes clear someone will do whatever it takes to break them apart. Now she's in too deep, and walking away isn't an option. But with the paparazzi and drama involved, Julie cannot help but wonder, who wants to love a billionaire? Hollywood producer Harry Jackson is not an alpha male. He's goofy, sensitive, and will move mountains to make everyone happy. In fact, he requires a whole team of people to keep him from being robbed blind. Sometimes he even needs saving from his love of bad puns. But when an enemy threatens to jeopardize his chance at love, it's time to step up and fight. He's terrified, but the thought of losing Julie scares him more. Pick up Who Wants to Love a Billionaire? The Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton.
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Mike Chen on the show with me. His book last year, Here and Now and Then, was one of my absolute favorite books of the year, and he's got a brand new book that is out available everywhere now in hardcover, audiobook, and Kindle edition. It's called A Beginning at the End. And let me tell you what, Mike, you never know what to expect from a follow-up of a book that you really love or from an author that you really love. And let me tell you, this book absolutely knocks it out of the park. Super excited to have you with me today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for reading and appreciating the second book. It's a giant fear, you know, that the second book is just going to fade into obscurity or not make people happy. So, that means a lot.
It's absolutely phenomenal. Got so much to talk about, but before we do, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I would say I used to draw comic strips, because I loved reading, you know, the comic strips back when, you know, newspapers still existed. So I used to have like a binder with sheets of paper in it, and I would just draw like these random stories, and they were usually about like my friends or my family and like, you know, my stuffed animals and things like that, and, you know, just in little interactions that made no sense. And then I was probably 6, 7, 8 when I was doing that. And then I got a little bit older and I started doing that into more like fan fiction of things that I really loved. And so it's always kind of been there. I didn't really explore like full prose style until college, though, even though I wrote essays and stuff in, you know, high school, like you as assignments, and I found it to be pretty easy, pretty natural. But from a pure story perspective, I didn't really think about it in that sort of long form until college.
We talk a lot about, are writers born or are they made? And, you know, I think you can make a pretty good argument, both ways, but there are some folks that just, it's just all they ever have thought about. It's just always been a part of who they are. And it sounds like you're one of those people that the gift of storytelling has just always been there bubbling under the surface. Was there ever an adult, one of your parents, excuse me, one of your parents maybe, or a teacher, that recognized this innate gift?
Kind of. So it's funny, and I have like a good story and a bad story about that. I was in, I remember very specifically 5th grade. My teacher, like, we had to write a sequel to one of the books that we read. I wrote, there's a classic children's book called Sign of the Beaver, about, a family. Like, I'm trying to remember the actual story, but it was basically like a family moves into like a native area, and like they have to learn not, like, lean on each other to survive like a native family. And, you know, it's like a Wild West time. And I wrote a sequel to that where, like, the two boys in their respective families went on an adventure together, and like one had to sacrifice themselves because they were being attacked by a bear. And I thought it was very poignant and had a lot of weight about friendship and stuff and death, obviously. My 5th grade teacher was just horrified, and she was like, "I don't want any of this horror movie stuff in my classroom." And I was like, "But it's about the importance of friendship and how they, you know, one will sacrifice the other because they love each other and like they're best friends, even though their families come from different places." I thought it was beautiful, but yeah, my teacher did not like it. On the flip side to that, in college, when the creative writing class I took, it was the first one that I took, like, formally, and it felt really natural. And I remember, like, after the first story I wrote in there, it felt like this weird type of freedom almost to just kind of like be creating without the limitations. So before that, I was almost a graphic design major in college. Like, that's originally what I wanted to be, like, because I did a lot of drawing in middle school and high school. And I've been a musician my whole life, so I was always exploring like these different types of artistic avenues. And music is still super important to me. But then with writing, like, it felt like a different type of freedom. You weren't limited by your tools. You know, you were just kind of allowing your imagination to just go wild. And so my teacher there, this was in, I believe, my early senior year of college, and she asked me to change majors. And I was an engineering major, and I was like, I can't throw away, you know, all these physics and math and engineering classes that I've already taken. And she just told me to keep writing. And then when I got my agent, I looked her up, and she's an executive at Simon & Schuster now. And so we've stayed in touch, And she's seen, you know, all like my work come out and when I've gotten new contracts and other things like that. And she'll tell me that if she's like at an industry event and she'll see my book, you know, in the room for like a marketing trade show or whatever. So her name is Wendy Sheenan. And she was the first person I sent an advance copy to when I got my debut. And she's mentioned in my acknowledgments, and like, I keep her in touch with every event that happens. She's one of those teachers where if I never encountered her, everything would be totally different. Like, I don't think I would be doing this.
Man, that, I don't know what that makes you believe in, but, when you look back and you see that this person, you know, went through serendipity or whatever, is placed in my life, and then my life becomes completely different. That's, it sounds like a Mike Chinn book.
Yeah, it does. I should take that.
You should take that. Yeah. That interaction with the fifth grade teacher, that negative feedback and response that you got, did that, discourage you or negatively affect you at all, or did that just kind of steal your resolve?
It kind of made my you know, screw you resolve a little bit there, because I was like, I just felt like she didn't get it, you know. It was like, you know, I remember shortly after we went to, we somehow got tickets to an advanced screening of Terminator 2, and that was the first time that like I felt like real emotion at the end of a movie, you know, like when the Terminator sacrifices himself and he does like the thumbs up as he's like, you know, sinking into the molten metal. And I remember just feeling like, you know, understanding like the, you know, someone sacrificing themselves for like the greater good of their family. And I'm like, wow, this is really heavy. And then I thought back to that book or that short story assignment I wrote. And I'm like, wait a minute, I did this right. I think like I understood those themes. And like you kind of see it in other heavy children's literature, like where I really think about just the feeling of it, even though I can't remember too many of the specifics, is Where the Red Fern Grows. Which is like the super messed up one that like, you know, why are we doing this about beautiful dogs? But like, you know, that sort of weight that comes with storytelling, I just felt like she didn't get it, but I did.
It's so sad for someone in such a position of influence, you know, and authority, that her words could have, and thank God that it, you know, didn't have this effect on you. But, you know, we have to really be careful how we encourage young people, because you just never know what weight that's going to carry.
Yeah. And I think we're in a different time now where, I think about like, she was a very irritable teacher, and she often used shame as a way to like communicate with her students. And I don't think that would fly. I can see it now where I was like, you know, I think about my daughter, if my daughter, you know, heard the way that like, you know, that she talks to her class, cause my daughter's five and she's going to start kindergarten next year. And so I'm like hyper aware of, and so if I heard a teacher talking that way, I would be like, oh no, we're going to have a chat about this.
Oh, that's so funny. So funny. So this, this college teacher, it encourages you to switch majors and completely upend your life. What did you start working on, at that point? Was Here and Now and Then the first book that you wrote, or, you know, are you like the rest of us and have desk drawer novels or, you know, trunk novels?
Yeah. No, there was a detour. So I, after college, I actually put a pause on it for a little bit because, so this is college. This was like in the late 90s. And so like the internet was just kind of starting to bubble. And there was, it was the very early days of sports journalism on the internet. And, a lot of the smaller sites, they just wanted writers. Like they didn't care what kind of background you had. And I knew I could write well. And I had I still am obsessed with hockey. And so like, I have an engineering mind. Like, I think I was just born with that too. And that's actually a way I approach writing my stories, but we can talk about that later. I'm to observe, like, you know, why things happened in hockey and then like write about it. And it just came really naturally for me. So I started writing like without pay for like these sites on like the early internet, and those sites would get absorbed by bigger media sites. Like, and I wound up eventually writing for Fox Sports and contributing to like Yahoo Sports and NHL.com. And I did that for about 10 years after college. And it was, you know, in a way it was everything that I wanted. I was like interviewing players, and like I had access to, you know, if I wanted to fly out to the All-Star game, I could have, you know, gone do that, and you know, that sort of press access. And it was really cool, but it also came with a lot of responsibility, because like if a story broke, then it would be like, okay, wife, I'm going to, you know, go hide upstairs for 2 hours while we figure out where this trade rumor is coming from and if it's real. And like that kind of stuff was like, it was just a lot of time suck. And then I felt like, okay, I put in about 10 years of this. I accomplished everything that I wanted to, and I'd really like to get back into fiction. And I finally found a critique partner. So this is about 2008, 2009. I'd finally found a critique partner that I really felt in step with, and that helped a lot. And we're still critique partners now. So around that time, I decided, like, I'm going to slow down and eventually phase out of sports writing. I wound up, I still like the journalism aspect of it, but I wanted to shift my focus to my other big interest, which is science fiction and geek stuff. So I started writing video game reviews and contributing pieces to major geek websites. And my secret marketing strategy here was thinking, like, if I actually sell a book someday, then if I make good connections with these editors and these sites, then hopefully they'll support me with, you know, exposure and stuff. And it did work out that way. Actually, it's been a good symbiotic relationship that way.
That's fantastic. It sounds like you have purposefully kind of built the life and career that you wanted to. And I love that there are more and more opportunities to do that nowadays.
Yeah. And I would say, like, when I talk to people now, like I've talked to a few like college level and high school level classes, and they'll often ask about not just fiction, but like the other type of writing that I do. And I tell them that like 15, 20 years ago, you could not just build something on your own, but you can now. And like, it's the same thing with visual artists that just, you know, post on DeviantArt or whatever, where like the best of it like gets noticed, you know. Yeah. It gets passed on social media and people turn it into careers.
I know a number of book cover artists that have gotten their start just by posting stuff up on DeviantArt.
Yeah, all you have to do really is just work hard and understand that at the beginning, there's going to be a sacrifice, or I guess more of like an investment in time, a pay. But if you're good at it and you're really passionate about it, you're going to do it anyways. So then you want to think about the installing like the mechanisms for it to be seen. It doesn't really work that way with long form fiction. Like, you can't really do that with a novel. It's too massive. But short stories and fan fiction, if you do enough of that, that is one avenue to build your writing community. I wouldn't say necessarily get discovered, because that's kind of like a one in a million shot. But the more important part, I think, is building community, discovering other writers that share your sensibilities and that you can talk honestly with. And that's, for me, my critique partner, we met, it was right before social media really came into the scene, but she and I met because I wrote a piece for Writer's Digest about how it was like five ways journalism can help your fiction writing or something like that. Like, I just pitched it to them and they took it. And then she emailed me, I think, about it, because she was like a technical writer at the time. And I had mentioned in the story that like I have a technical writing background. I think that's how it went. We've known each other for so long now. But then we just kind of realized that, hey, we work well together. And at the time I was actually writing contemporary stories, not science fiction. And she is the person, her name is Sierra Godfrey, and she's a brilliant writer too. She's the one who encouraged me to, when I was feeling complacent, or not complacent, but just like a little frustrated with contemporary settings. And I said, I really like the dynamics of these stories, but I don't feel like they're not really fun for me to write. I wish I could just stick them on a spaceship or something. And she goes, why don't you just try doing that? And I thought at the time there was no market for it. And this was about 2011 or so. And then she goes, well, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But, you know, if you have fun writing it, then you'll get better anyways. So I did that. And the first manuscript I tried for that was the third manuscript that I had attempted. And that one actually went on the shelf for a few years. And then my agent pulled it out. And that is what became A Beginning at the End.
Nice. Nice.
Heavily revised. heavily revised.
Yeah, well, sure. But that's I love the idea that something, you know, I think a lot of people think of the early things that we write. Well, that's just practice. It'll go. No one will ever see it. But a lot of times there's some great kernels of story in there. And maybe the whole book doesn't get published as it is. But salvaging those things can be great sometimes.
Yeah, I would say this is like the extreme end of the good things could happen, because the basic story arc and the world are completely the same since my first draft in 2011. It's just structurally different. There's more points of view. There's way more interstitials about the world, news articles and historic speeches and things like that. And the writing is just way better and the pacing is better. But if you look at the a bullet point list of the overall arc of the story and who the main characters are, all of that's the same. So it just needed some, my agent to read it, because I knew something was not right with it. I had queried agents at the time and it was getting a really good request rate, based on the pitch, because the pitch is really unique. It still is. But then no one offered on it. And then I put that away and I started working on Here and Now and Then. But then when my agent pulled this off the shelf, he said, there's a lot of good stuff here, but I really want you to try X, Y, and Z with it. And he gave me homework reading of Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11. And he said, read this, but don't just read it for fun. Read it specifically to see how she structures the different points of view and makes the story coalesce into the final act. And so that's what I did with my book, was break it apart and rebuild it together after learning the lessons from specifically studying Station 11. So that's a really extreme example of something that you did early on becoming successful or becoming important later. I think for the most part, you just want to keep a file of everything, or a folder of everything that you've done, because you could always mine a conversation or a setting or an action piece or something that goes later on. Trying to revive a previously shelved manuscript is really rewarding, but also really difficult, because your original manuscript is filled with all sorts of bad habits that you just needed to work out as you evolve as a writer. And undoing those is a process in itself.
Right. Talk for just a moment, if you would, about the relationship with your critique partner, because the way you phrased it, it makes me wonder if you had some bad experiences with critique partners. And I know that writing groups and things like that are popular with a lot of writers right now. But I also know quite a few writers that the writing group is almost crippling to them, because it's just too much feedback and it's too many ideas and things that just go astray, and people wind up just, their whole writing career is going to writing group and nothing fruitful ever comes from it. And it sounds like you have an amazing relationship with your critique partner. But is there a flip side to that, or has there been a flip side to that for you?
Yeah, I'd say when I was in that creative writing class in college that I mentioned, I really liked how my teacher said, we were one of the assignments, every assignment, actually, we had to do a critique discussion. And we would talk about everyone's work for like 5 minutes. And I like how my teacher had positioned it with, like, the first thing you do is you start off with something positive. So the writer doesn't feel like they're on the defense right away. And then you have to be constructive. You can't be negative without being constructive. Otherwise, it doesn't do anything. But you also have to be honest. That honesty is important, because without it, the other people are never going to learn. I did a few critique groups, and none of them were really felt fruitful. I remember, like, in particular, there was one guy who was just so stuck on technical grammar that he didn't understand style. And he was like, he would be like, "Oh, you've got a fragment here." And I'm like, "I know I have a fragment there. That is the narrator's voice." You know, it's like when you're in someone's stream of consciousness, it's not always going to be subject, predicate, you know, very smooth, or very, like, technically correct grammar. It's going to have rhythm to it. And he didn't get that at all. And it just really infuriated me, because he was super condescending about it too. So you had people like that. And then you had other people who were just like, they couldn't express constructive criticism. It was too hard for them to be, I guess, not mean, but, you know, to say negative things about it, like to say, "Hey, this pacing is off, but I think you should try X, Y, and Z to do it." They would just say things like, "I think that's pretty good," but you would get nothing out of it. So my critique partner, we have this agreement. We jokingly call it diplomatic brutality, where we will be absolutely brutal with each other, but we will say it in a nice way, because we know that this, like, brutality is necessary to push each other to really, like, you know, get better. And we know, we've worked with each other long enough that we know each other's strengths and weaknesses. And I think we've both gotten better at those weaknesses. But we'll identify them where, you know, like, I'll say something like, "Oh yeah, you're doing, you know, X, Y, Z again." And she'll say the same thing to me. And so I'm fortunate that, like, we still have a relationship, even though, like, you know, we're living on deadlines now. Like, she hasn't sold yet, but she's agented, and, you know, I'm on contract. And so the way that we can work with each other has to be different now, because we can't just wait for, you know, 90,000 words to pop out and then we give it to the other person and wait a few months for feedback. Like, that's just not possible anymore. So, but we'll give each other sections, or we'll just talk through story ideas on online, like, while we're supposed to be working, we'll be chatting. I think it's really, really important to find that type of person that can be in, like, the right rhythm on a communication level with you, and also have a sharp eye critically, and then be able to, like, build a relationship off of that.
Right. I love that. And that obviously comes from a relationship of trust. Being able to communicate with each other like that is born out of, you know, many, many, many conversations and learning to trust each other. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. The new book, A Beginning at the End, is, has been a little easier for me to, genre-wise defined for people that I'm talking about the book to. Your first book, Here and Now and Then, is a little more difficult to put into a single bucket, you know, when you're having conversations. I love this book so much, but it's a little, you know, it's science fiction, but at the same time, it really goes emotionally deep, which we don't always see in a lot of science fiction. And it's kind of you know, genre bending, I think I've seen people say about it. It's kind of all over the place in terms of, in those kind of bookish terms. Where did the story come from, and what usually comes first for you? Is it a character? Is it you know, a plot device? You know, I wonder what would happen if I did this, or is it a setting? How does the kernel of the story usually grow for you?
I'd say it's definitely the plot device and the setting come first. And then I sketch out a skeleton first drafts where, like, the characters, they may not even have, like, you know, visible features assigned to them other than, like, you know, man A and woman B or child C, or, you know, it's like everything's very placeholder at that point. In the first draft, it's mostly dialogue and very loose prose and sometimes just bullet point, like stage direction, like they go here and they fight type of stuff. And that's for me to like try to work out specifically what the story is supposed to be about and what the character motivations are, because at the very beginning, they're very loose sketches. It takes me a few revisions to really feel like I can sink into the voice of the characters. And then usually I'd say like around so the first pass is really just like a skeleton. The second pass, I try to fill out with the prose. And from there I can start to really feel the voice and understand like the world that I'm building. And then the third draft is like when I start to like go through what I've already written and then be like, oh, does this make sense for the characters now that I understand them? And I'd say it's like 75% yes. And then 25% no, I have to rewrite pieces and plot points. And then also like the idea of like, oh, what if they decided to do blank instead of this and see where that goes? I'm influenced a lot by the media that I'm currently consuming at the time. So with a beginning at the end, the original idea, so this came around 2011, and it was really sparked by a scene from season 2 of The Walking Dead, where Laurie and Carl are like talking about like the importance of Carl still doing homework, you know, in the apocalypse. And I thought that was a really interesting idea of it spun off this question of like, if society did stabilize, then like, how would they like unpack all the stuff that they'd experienced? Because in the show, obviously it goes, you know, way off in the other direction, but there was like this one really quiet moment in that season where they're having a very human parent-child connection about it. And I thought that would be a really interesting setting to project out in a different way. And then I took the idea of one of my writer inspirations is Nick Hornby. I really lean on About a Boy as like one of my like perfect books, where if I'm struggling with something, I'll go back and read passages of it just to kind of feel like getting back into a rhythm. And I thought the idea of like take About a Boy and stick it in like this weird post-apocalyptic setting and see what happens, like that's kind of like just the very, very generic idea that sparked this book. With Here and Now and Then, I was watching a lot of Doctor Who, like, I mean, more than usual, and Doctor Who and Torchwood. So time travel was on my mind, and there were two specific episodes. There was a Doctor Who episode called School Reunion, where the Doctor encounters one of his old companions from the 80s version of the show. So the Doctor has regenerated into this, you know, David Tennant, like dashing young man form. But the companion, Sarah Jane, has just aged naturally. And like they talk about like the impact of time on like their friendship and where has he gone and things like that. And I had seen it back to back on TV with an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation called The Inner Light. And in that episode, Picard gets hit with a probe that knocks him unconscious, and he experiences the lifetime of another person, of a dying civilization. And it's like he's only been knocked out for like 8 minutes. And so both of those kind of play off the same theme. And so it was just taking that and then taking those episodes and like the theme of time on relationships, and it just kind of sparked these questions in my head. So I think about like the big picture and the themes and I guess the subgenre first, and then everything else kind of fills in.
With Here and Now and Then, like you mentioned, time travel is kind of at the core of this story. And we love a great time travel story. But done if you're not careful with time travel, it can become hokey. It can become a crutch, and you know, it can really make a story not live up to its potential. How do you handle something so precious with a story like this? Because here, now, and then, you know, it's such an emotional ride, and you don't lean on the thing that that would be so easy to lean on. How do you balance using a trope like that?
You have a good editor that helps. So there's two things that I was working for. Was one of them is like the world, which I think is important, that in that it has to be believable, but I didn't want to overtake the story. I knew the story was always about, I think that the stories that I write could in a way move laterally into different settings. Like, you know, you just would have to adapt some of the mechanics of it, but the core relationships could work in different settings. And so with Here, Now, and Then, like, I knew I wanted the major theme to be like distance between parent and child, and what is important in a relationship, and how do you really know a person after time has passed. So if you look at the structure of that book, it's actually very linear. Like, it starts in one time period, then it shifts to another, and then it goes to another. So it's not like some time travel stories where there's a lot of flipping between things and creating ripple effects. It's actually pretty simple from a structure perspective. So for me, it was making sure that structure worked, and then making sure that the logic of it worked too. And one of the final things my editor did before we said we were done on it, she gave me a list of questions that she thought were like typical sci-fi or time travel tropes. And she said, we haven't addressed these yet. You have to make a list of how you're going to world build around them, and then like insert them into the book to seal off any questions people might have about, like, you know, why can't you just keep going back, or why can't you kill Hitler, or, you know, why can't you go back 5,000 years, or, you know, that sort of stuff. And she said, like, if you can seal those off in the middle of the prose, then people aren't going to ask the questions and they can focus on the story. So I think because I tend to edit in layers, that's a approach that I've started to use. Is save like the minute world building questions for the very end, and then just find a way to integrate them into the story.
The new book, which has been out about a week now, A Beginning at the End, really takes a trope, a subject matter that we're all very familiar with over the last decade or so. You know, looking at stories of dystopia, looking at stories of, you know, a post-apocalypse, have been front and center in our collective imaginations. And we could probably dissect that and tell us some things about ourselves. But, you know, these stories, you know, everything from YA, like the Hunger Games, and, to, you know, The Walking Dead, like you said, these stories are important to us right now. But even in the title of this book, you tell us that this is a different kind of post-apocalypse, and it's not a dystopia, not a utopia by any means, but this book is a hopeful look at the end of the world. You know, the title itself, A Beginning at the End, is intriguing. You mentioned The Walking Dead earlier. What was it? I know that this was something that you worked on earlier, but as you got the book back out and started working on it again, what were some of the important things that you had in mind that you wanted this book to do?
I think from the very beginning, I wanted it to be to cover that area that you never see in post-apocalyptic stories, because you usually see like early days outbreak and panic and chaos where everyone's just murdering each other because they don't know how to deal with it. Or you see like, you know, 100 years from now, or like some unknown time from now where like everything is just completely different, like the Hunger Games, where like, you know, some sort of unknown cataclysmic event has happened and society and the survivors have reshaped into this dystopia. I wanted to really look at if it was the same on the surface level. So when you read the book, that if you took a snapshot of the characters in a scene, and it'd be like, okay, well, they're in a city and there are cars and they're talking to each other and there's like a coffee shop on the corner, like the surface is totally the same. But then when you look closer and you could realize, like, in the setting, like, hey, wait, there's a bunch of boarded up buildings and like things are not working. And then like on an emotional level, like, you know, people are wearing like gas masks and, you know, they're kind of afraid to talk to each other. And you go layer by layer deeper about like, okay, each layer comes with its own set of like world and emotional and family trauma. That was a really interesting area that there's not too many places that really go there. So this book is set specifically after, like, in the early days of a rebuilding period where survival is no longer the concern. It's how do you restore society and how do you maintain society when everyone is carrying trauma with them? And that was just, I think as we revived in 2016 and 2017, you know, you start to absorb allegories because the world is kind of chaos right now. And then, but the foundation of those allegories was always there. It just kind of sharpened in a way. And I had a reader tell me, like, wow, some of this feels like really plausible. And I'm like, I didn't intend for that to happen. Like, it just kind of happens that way because of it's this near future, like, very grounded story, very grounded world. And so, you know, with a few deviations into, like, you know, really bad things happening, like, it always had potential to feel like real. But I think because everyone's kind of in a panic state right now, it feels even more cautious.
Yeah. What one interesting thing about this book are the way that you explore the societies that that people kind of form themselves into, you know, in this rebuilding. What were some of the things that you were exploring with the types of groups of people and how they kind of governed themselves and grouped into?
I think it came with, like, what it felt logical that, like, if the government basically authorized, like, these self-sustaining city-states in existing infrastructure, like, I would imagine that a lot of people would gravitate towards that because it's as normal as you can get. I imagine also that there was going to be a certain group of people that would just want to, like, live, you know, in, like, just be traveling, you know, basically like Mad Max style adventure gains. Because I think that sort of anarchist, lifestyle would be appealing to them. And then I think it would make sense that there'd be a severe level of distrust among, like, traditional ways of living. And so to have people form, like, communes in stable areas. In my book, I chose for these communities to take over college campuses because they're no longer being used and they all function as basically miniature cities. So if you have a group of people, like, of, you know, 500,000, 2,000 people all working together on these communes, I think that seems like a very realistic thing to happen. And it would make sense to me that there'd be people who would want to have some form of, I guess, traditional living, but without the trust of, like, a larger governmental oversight type of thing. So it was really just kind of projecting out, like, what did I think people would actually gravitate towards, and knowing that, you know, there's probably more in between, but I don't have space for it. So I'm just going to limit it to several perspectives.
There are so many great characters in this book. One of my favorites became Moira because she has such an interesting story. A former pop star who finds herself at the end of the world. That must have been fun to write.
It's funny because Moira was originally not a point of view in the book. It was originally in the 2011 draft. It was Rob and Krista as the points of view. And Moira was a side character who kind of helped throttle the story along. And then when my agent took the story and he said, you should boost to, like, four points of view. and find ways to like intercut between them. And he said, Moira is way too interesting to not be a point of view. And I had all this material, like I knew where she came from. I knew what her backstory was and I knew like what her motivations were. I just hadn't written from her point of view before. So she was, I think she's only gotten maybe two or three additional scenes that were purely her point of view. Almost everything else like existed in some form before. And I just flipped it from rather being Krista or Rob's point of view over to Moira's point of view. But she was probably so far, a lot of people have gravitated towards her because of the, you know, it's fun to think about like someone who is probably one of the most famous people on the planet before an apocalypse and then just going for the flip side after that. The apocalypse, I think, is a really great metaphor for so many things. You know, we see it as, over the years, like They Live. The apocalypse was, or like the alien invasion was like a metaphor for capitalism. And we see it for like climate change and racism and so many other things. In my book, it's really about like the trauma that we carry with us. And Moira is a really great way to see it, like how the trauma of childhood could make you just want to hide. And it's almost, it's a mirror to Krista in the book who the trauma of her childhood makes her want to put herself out there as like a, you know, a strike first mentality. So they do wind up mirroring each other.
Well, the new book is called A Beginning at the End. The most fun I've ever had at the end of the world. I'll tell you that. It's such a fantastic book. Mike, I hope that it just does gangbusters for you. It's out everywhere now in hardcover, audiobook, and Kindle edition. There's links to it in the show notes of this episode. Mike, if people are just learning about you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yeah, I'm social media. I'm the most active on Twitter. I mentioned earlier that I do write for a number of geek media sites. So in addition to talking about fiction writing and craft and books that I love, on Twitter, I'm often talking about Star Trek and Star Wars and Doctor Who and plugging the articles that I've written for. Like, I just had one come out for StarTrek.com about like Captain Picard as like this beacon of hope for us in difficult times. I will do a lot about that on Twitter. That's Mike Chen Writer. And you have to be careful because there's Mike Chen, the like YouTube food guy who so I've gotten his fan mail before and I'm like, yeah, I'm not him. Sorry about that. And there's a few other Mike Chens out there. And even sometimes my friends will tag the wrong ones still because we're just all kind of grouped together. So Mike Chen Writer. And then my website is MikeChenBooks.com. And that kind of has like the general, like, you know, here's my books, here's some excerpts, here's some the links to them and general news updates about like the specific book side of things.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to see you and to pick up their copy of A Beginning at the End. Mike, I love what you're doing, and I'm a big fan. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, thank you. I love talking about craft. I'm so happy that you had me on.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. Humanity's only hope of survival. Enter the solar system at nearly the speed of light. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information, and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class,
he thought. Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app?
He thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked. You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa. Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to his ear, Mark stopped and looked around before deciding how to continue. Spiked ocotillo plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?
He asked the mysterious caller. You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire? The caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
If you're so close, why can't I see you?
He asked. He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow patty.